Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me to welcome you to this first Institute seminar of the Lent term. We are taking advantage of a certain tercentenary to have this seminar, and in both the choice of subject and the choice of speaker. Before I introduce our speaker, John Bull, I'd like to take just a few words to say something about the historical background. This is the 300th anniversary of Newton's celebrated solution of the problem of the brachistochrone. That is, the determination of the curve of swiftest descent between two points, A and B, with B located below, but not vertically below A. I take the following facts, first and foremost, from Professor Whiteside's definitive edition of the scientific papers of Isaac Newton, and secondly, from the correspondence of Isaac Newton, edited by Rupert Hall. Both works are in the library of the Institute, and please forgive me if I repeat facts that are already, in consequence, well known to you. Briefly, the story is this. On 29th January 1697, that is 300 years ago plus a few days, Newton, who was then 54 years old and had moved 9 months previously from Cambridge to London to take up appointment as Warden of the Mint, and who had thrown himself into this work with great dedication. Newton arrived home, tired, after a hard day's work at the Tower of London, and found this challenge awaiting him. He stayed up most of the night working on the problem, and in fact on a second problem, which I'll mention in a moment, and the next morning he delivered the answers, though not the method by which he had obtained them, by letter to his friend Charles Montagu, who had studied under Newton at Trinity College, Cambridge, and who was now, remarkably, both Chancellor of the Exchequer and President of the Royal Society. Newton's solution revealed that the form of the brachistochrone is a cycloid. I show you here the first page of his paper, which appears in Philtrans, volume 19, and in the issue of January 1697. Recall that Newton only received the problem on the 29th of January 1697. This is an extraordinary tribute to the speed of publication in those days. I don't think that Philtrans comes anywhere near this now. Of course, the issue of January perhaps didn't appear until April or May, but nevertheless, it's still very remarkable. Actually, what happened is that the paper was read to the assembled Royal Society on the 24th of February, and so the critical period was between the end of January and the 24th of February, so we're very well placed now on the 17th of February to have this tercentenary celebration. Well, now, the provenance of this problem was rather interesting. The challenge had arrived by letter from Johann Bernoulli, one of the Bernoulli, the great Bernoulli family, Johann was a professor of mathematics at the University of Groningen. He had earlier, about 6 months previously, published the problem as a challenge in the one of the journals published in Leipzig, but it appears that this journal was not perhaps very widely distributed or widely read, and by Christmas, nobody had succeeded in solving the problem. A version of the problem had actually reached Oxford, I have to say. And allow me to quote from Whiteside's introduction. He says, "In Oxford, a certain Swiss, very likely Bernoulli's youngest brother, Hieronymus, who was then in England, brought the challenge to identify the brachistochrone to John Wallace's eye in September following, but he could only helplessly pass it on in December. The three intervening months of silence on Wallace's part speaks mutely for itself, to his fellow Savilian professor, David Gregory," that's in Oxford, "who in turn spent two further wasted months in trying to demonstrate that the catenary is the required curve of quickest descent, till he was put right the next February by Newton, fresh from his own correct resolution," so on. In Bernoulli's challenge letter, which Newton actually reproduces in its entirety in Latin, preceding this his own stated solution of the problem. There is one wonderful paragraph that I would also like to quote in full. Having posed the problem and indicated the reasonable hypotheses with which any problem solver could start, for example, that it was reasonable, Bernoulli said, to adopt the hypothesis of Galileo that the velocities acquired by falling bodies are in the subduplicate ratio of the heights traversed. Well, he went on to say, provided, therefore, no obscurity remains, we earnestly ask the geometers of this age, one and all, forthwith to gird themselves to the task and to investigate all that they keep hidden in the innermost recesses of their methods. Let him who can grasp the reward we have prepared for the one who solves, a reward which is not a sum of gold or silver. I think he was here referring to the fact that Newton was at the mint and was spending all his time minting gold and silver coins. Not a sum of gold or silver, for that is a reward by which only mean and mercenary minds are hired. minds from which we expect nothing, either meritorious or fruitful for knowledge. But since virtue is its own perfect reward, and since glory provides an immense stimulus to action, we offer a prize suited to a man of free birth, a prize composed of the honor, the praise, and the applause with which we mean, publicly and privately, in words spoken and written, to crown, to decorate, and to celebrate the perspicacity of our great Apollo-like seer. That really, I think, is a wonderful paragraph, which we should bear in mind often when we undertake research for miserable financial gain. But anyway, Newton solved the problem overnight and published it within a matter of weeks. It was not, it has to be said, one of his finest achievements by any means. In fact, Whiteside makes some rather derogatory remarks about the achievement. He suggests that Newton could actually have solved this problem quite easily some 12 or 15 years earlier with the knowledge that he then had. And at that time, when he was a younger man, he could have done it in a matter of minutes rather than taking 12 hours, as is recorded. He started the problem at 4 in the afternoon, and he went to bed at 4 the following morning, having solved the problem of the brachistochrone and the other geometrical problem, which was really just a problem in Cartesian geometry. But I think it has to be said that Whiteside really doesn't do full justice. After all, to solve a problem is one thing, and to write the paper in finished form and submit it the next morning for publication is quite another. All of us would agree. It was a rather phenomenal achievement, a polished paper, solving the two problems and submitted there and then for publication. That was Newton's style. Of course, he had to get back to work at the Mint the next day, and this was simply a little diversion. Well, now, with these, there's very much more that could be said, as Professor Whiteside himself said to me in a long two-page letter that he sent to me just last week, a long and very interesting letter concerning this problem. He said I could go on at length, and I'm sure he could. But the purpose of this meeting is to hear about the calculus of variations after 300 years as it is and as it is used today. And it is a great honor for me to introduce Professor John Bull, FRS, who has recently moved from Heriot Watt University, where he was for many years professor of applied analysis, to take up the Sedleian chair, not the civilian chair, but the Sedleian chair of natural philosophy at the University of Oxford. His move is very recent. In fact, he's just been completing the move of his house, I believe, just during these last few days. And so we're actually very lucky to get him here on this occasion. So I've given you the title of his talk. I've told you, I should say also, of course, that he is this year, quite recently, elected president of the London Mathematical Society. And I should take this opportunity to say how grateful we are at the Isaac Newton Institute for the support that the London Mathematical Society has given us since the foundation of the Institute 5 years ago. So without further wasting your time, allow me to present Professor John Bull. Thank you.
So, let me begin by thanking Keith Moffitt for giving me the opportunity to speak on the occasion of this tercentenary. I found it impossible to resist the temptation to give what will inevitably be a very personal view of how the calculus of variation stands today, how it got there, and where it might be going. And so let me briefly describe a plan of the talk. First of all, I'll say a few words about the Brocristi-Krohn problem and use it to introduce a few more modern ideas. Secondly, discuss some highlights of the one-dimensional calculus of variations. It's my view that if you don't understand what's going on in one dimension, you're hardly likely to understand what's going on in higher dimensions. And then talk about the multiple integral problems for the higher dimensional case, then discuss some of the outstanding open problems of the current theory, and finally, if there's time, say something about the future. So let me begin then by talking about the Brocristi-Krohn. So as Keith has described, this is the problem of finding the curve between two points down which a particle will slide without friction in the shortest time. So let me take the x-axis to be horizontal and the y-axis vertically downwards, and let's take the two points to be the origin and the point x equals 1 and y equals y1. Now, really it's best to consider this non-parametrically so that the curve can loop like this. But let me make the simplifying assumption that it's a graph. So we're looking for a curve y as a function of x. And the problem is to minimize the following integral, t of y, which is the time of travel, which is the integral from 0 to 1 of the square root of 1 plus dy dx squared divided by y dx. Among curves satisfying the end conditions y of 0 is 0 and y of 1 is y1, which I take to be bigger than or equal to 0. It's starting with 0 velocity, and so obviously it can't get, by conservation of energy, it can't get above the line y equals 0. Now, what Bernoulli, Leibniz, and Newton did was, in a modern way of thinking, somehow solve the Euler-Lagrange equation for this problem. And in fact, that there is a unique solution of the Euler-Lagrange equation joining these two points, and it is a cycloid. This, it could move up at the end. This is, let me call this y bar, which is a cycloid. Now, although the calculus of variations could be traced back to the ancient Greeks, Pappus, for example, discussed isoperimetric problems, it's fair enough to say that the discussion of this problem in 1696 and 1697 by these fine mathematicians marked the beginning of the modern era of the calculus of variations. On the other hand, from a modern perspective, they didn't, in fact, solve the problem, as stated. What they did was they showed that if there is a curve that minimizes this integral, and if that curve is sufficiently smooth, then it is this cycloid. Now, at the time when they were thinking about this, there weren't well-known examples of problems of the one-dimensional calculus of variations which did not have minimizers. And so the sort of confusion here between necessary and sufficient conditions was not so obvious. So let me describe two examples, well-known examples, of one-dimensional problems where the minimum is not attained. So the first is to minimize I of y, which is the integral from 0 to 1 of dy dx all squared minus 1 all squared plus y squared dx with n conditions y of 0 equals y of 1 is equal to 0. Sorry. Now, the infimum of this integral among all curves satisfying these end conditions is 0, but it's not attained. This is very easy to see. Well, first of all, it's very easy to see that if the infimum is 0, it's not attained, because the only way you can make this 0 is to have y equals 0, but then dy dx is 0 and the integral gives the value 1. So the question is, can you find a sequence yj such that I of yj tends to 0? And that's easy to do. You take a zigzag line with slopes plus or minus 1, giving the end conditions where, say, this distance is 1 over j. So, of course, that gives a value 0 to the first part of the term and of the integral, and as j goes to infinity, this goes to 0. Now, if you don't like having curves which have corners on, then you could just smooth the corners a little bit, and the same argument would work. Now, stepping ahead a couple of hundred years, L.C. Young took the point of view that in this problem, there is a minimum, there is a minimizer, provided you interpret what you mean by minimizer carefully enough, certainly not a classical kind of minimizer. What it would consist of would be an infinitesimal zigzag with slopes plus or minus 1, if you like, superimposed on the what he called the track of the generalized curve. So he would call a generalized curve, say this, together with this superimposed infinitesimal zigzag with where the slope takes the value plus 1 with probability half and minus 1 with probability of a half. We call these objects nowadays Young measures, and we call what he called the track, which in this case is 0, the weak limit of the sequence yj. So he took the point of view that if you interpreted what you meant by a minimizer correctly, you could in fact get attainment of a minimizer in this case, but there's certainly not attainment in any kind of standard interpretation of this integral. And we'll see later, I'll briefly mention that this kind of situation where you get an infinitesimal zigzag is of much current interest in connection with the microstructure of materials undergoing phase transformations. So that's one example. Now another example, quite similar, to minimize I of y, which is the integral from 0 to 1 of the square root of y squared plus yx squared dx, this time with boundary conditions y of 0 is 0, y of 1 is equal to 1. And in this case, the infimum of I is 1, but it's not attained. And one can see fairly easily that that for any y, I of y is bigger than 1, because this is bigger than the integral from 0 to 1 of dy dx. Dx, and by integrating the boundary conditions, this is 1. On the other hand, you can find a sequence ij, yj, such that I of yj tends to 1 by taking the point 1 minus 1 over j here, and it's got to go through the point 1, 1, and take the curve yj to be 0 up to here, and then this line there. And it's easy to check that with that definition, I of yj tends to 1. So those are two examples where the minimum is not attained. And the second one doesn't look all that different to this, so would give somebody, if they knew it, pause for thought. Well, how can one, in fact, prove that the cycloid does give the absolute minimum? Well, first of all, you've got to specify the problem a bit more precisely by saying what space of functions you're going to minimize the integral in. For example, this cycloid comes down with infinite slope here. If you chose smooth functions on the closed interval, the minimum would not be attained. And in general, it's a sort of message of the modern calculus of variations that what function space you choose to minimize integrals in is part of the model, sometimes as much part of the model as the functional itself. Choose different function spaces and you get different answers. So now here, the classical function space to choose, I'll write it as script A, would be the y's that are absolutely continuous on the closed interval 0, 1. That's the same thing as the continuous representatives of the Sobolev space W, 1, 1 of 0, 1. That's the set of y's which together with their first derivative are integrable. So the set of y's which are absolutely continuous with y bigger than or equal to 0, that's because physically we can't go above the original height, and then the boundary conditions. Y of 0 is 0, y of 1 is y1. And what we have to prove is that I of y, so required to prove that I of y is bigger than I of the cycloid, which I've called y bar, if y belongs to A and y is not equal to y bar. Now, the quickest way I know of doing this appears in a quite recent book of Troutman, 1996, and it involves a change of variables to convexify the problem. So what you do is you put y is equal to 2z squared, and then this integral turns, this should have been t here, not I, t of y bigger than t of y bar, and then this turns this integral into an integral in the unknown z, which is the integral from 0 to 1 of the square root of z to the minus 2 plus zx squared dx. And now we have to minimize it in the corresponding set of functions, which I'll call z, a bar, which is the z, which are absolutely continuous. If z bigger equal to 0, z of 0 is 0, and z of 1 being whatever it is, it's y 1 over 2 square root of that. And it's really almost a one-line proof with a little bit of analysis to do. You notice that the integrand, which I write as f of z and p, which is the square root of z to the minus 2 plus p squared, that this is a strictly convex function of z and p. And then that's the end, actually, of the proof. It's just an analog of saying that if I have a convex function and there's a point where the derivative is zero, that's what it means to say that we have a solution of the Euler-Lagrange equation, then that point gives a global minimum of the energy. So if you just write that down in the appropriate way, you find that that gives an extremely quick proof. Well, you have to do a little bit of analysis near the origin, but it's very easy. So that's part one. And now I'd like to move to part two, which is highlights of the one-dimensional theory. So here I'll discuss problem of integrals of the form I of y is the integral from A to B of f of x, y sub x, dx, y is always a scalar. And to keep things simple, I'll always suppose that f is smooth. And I'm interested in the behavior of this functional on a space of admissible functions, which I'll call A, which is again those y's that are absolutely continuous on the interval AB, with fixed end conditions, that y of A is some given number alpha, and that y of B is some different number beta. Now, the first thing I would like to describe is the Weierstrass theory of local minimizers. Now, we're very close to another significant anniversary, because Weierstrass died actually on the 19th of February, 1897. Historical research there. Now, Weierstrass was the first to realize that it made a tremendous difference what norm you used in defining what local means. Use a different norm and you get a completely different theory of local minimizers. So let me write down what his really famous theorem was in a sort of somewhat more modern form. I'll call it the fundamental sufficiency theorem of the calculus of variations. So let's suppose that we have a y bar, which is in A and is also C1 on the closed interval AB. And assume three things, which I'll explain what these are in a minute. First of all, that the first variation at y bar is zero. Secondly, that the second variation at y bar is strictly positive. And thirdly, that the strengthened Weierstrass condition holds. Then the conclusion is, and this implies that y bar is a local minimizer of I in L infinity of A, B. So, in fact, one has a precise statement that there exists a sigma positive and an epsilon positive, such that if you take any y, any admissible y, which in the L infinity norm, that's the max of the absolute value, is in the L infinity norm, the difference between y and y bar is less than epsilon, then we have that I of y is bigger equal to I of y bar plus sigma times the integral from A to B of d of yx minus y bar x dx. And this d is d of t is the root of 1 plus t squared minus 1. Now, so there are various things there which are not explained. The first is, what's the first variation? Let's take a phi that's smooth. A smooth phi with phi at A equals phi at B is zero. So the first variation, saying it vanishes, is merely saying that d dt of I of y bar plus t phi at t equals zero is equal to zero for all such phi. Saying that the second variation is strictly positive says that the second derivative of this is bigger than or equal to some positive constant gamma times the integral of phi squared plus phi x squared dx, again for all such phi. bar, whenever you have a y satisfying the end conditions, here's A and here's B, whenever it satisfies the end conditions and is close to y bar in the uniform norm and has a derivative that is close to y bar in the uniform norm. However, here we see another condition, a new necessary condition. Well, this is a strengthened version of it, but a new necessary condition to have a local minimizer in a stronger sense. In other words, a local minimizer in the sense that there's some band around here such that whatever curve you have joining these two endpoints, whatever happens to the derivative, however big the derivative is, I of y is going to be bigger than or equal to I of y bar. So Weierstrass found this necessary condition, and it's the following. You look at the graph of f at x, y bar of x, p against p. This is some curve. Now the value of the derivative y at the point x, y bar x at x, has to be a point at which the tangent to this curve does not lie above the curve. So that's a necessary condition. And the strengthened Weierstrass condition, which together with these two forms a set of sufficient conditions, says that the same picture has to hold if you allow yourself to move this argument and this argument by a small amount, independent of x. Well, this theorem is anything but obvious. There are three proofs of it that I know. The first was the one that appears in all the books, is Hilbert's version of Weierstrass's proof, which is the so-called field theory of the calculus of variations. A really marvelous proof. But in some sense too clever and not very adaptable. The second proof is less well known. It's the so-called indirect sufficiency proof, completely different, doesn't use any fields of extremals, of Hesternes, who was a member of the Chicago School of the Calculus of Variations around the Second World War. And then recently with Dick James, I found a third version of this, so a sort of direct version of this indirect proof, which uses finite elements. So this is a remarkable theorem, and I'll come back to it a bit later. Now the second highlight of one-dimensional theory I'd like to mention is Tonelli theory. Tonelli did his work in sort of about 1918 to 1939. And it was he who brought the Lebesgue integral and lower semi-continuity methods into the calculus of variations. So I give two results, one very well known and one not so well known. First of all, he had an existence theorem. Proved by the direct method of the calculus of variations. He says, suppose that f, as a function of the last variable, the derivative, is convex. And that f at x and y and p is bigger than or equal to a function phi of p, which grows superlinearly in p. So phi of p over the absolute value of p, the limit, as the absolute value of p tends to infinity, is infinity. So then there exists a global minimizer of I in A. Now, thinking back to the Procristochrone, I just rubbed off the functional, I think, but remember what it was, the square root of the integrand was the square root of 1 plus yx squared over y. Now, example 1 shows, in example 1, it's not convex, but it does satisfy this growth condition. In example 2, it is convex, but it doesn't satisfy the growth condition. So this is a pretty close to being optimal, and you see that the Procristochrone problem is in a sort of razor's edge case where you have convexity, but you don't have the growth condition, but where nevertheless there is a minimizer. So that was his existence. There is very well known, at least in its modern generalizations. Now the second result of his was, until fairly recently, hardly known at all, yet it's a precursor of modern partial regularity theorems. So it was his partial regularity theorem which says the following. Let's suppose that Y bar is a local minimizer in L infinity of AB, and that F, the second derivative with respect to P, is positive, so it's a strict convexity condition. Then there exists a set E, a closed set, closed subset of AB, with one-dimensional measure zero, such that Y bar belongs to C infinity of the interval AB with E removed. And on E, the derivative of Y bar is infinity, in a certain sense that I won't make precise. This theorem is optimal. Under the given hypothesis, you cannot, in general, assert more. That was proved by myself and Vic Mizell and by Sandy Davy. The picture is the following. We have the interval AB, and now we have the red set, the Tonelli set, E, or some set of measure zero. Now, so the complement is a union of open intervals, so let's take one of them. It's a smooth function on that open interval, therefore it satisfies the Euler-Lagrange equation on that interval. The whole function is continuous, so it does something like this. When it comes to the end of the interval, it comes up with infinite slope. And actually, if this was an isolated point of the interval, it would continue in the same direction. It couldn't come down like this. It would go like this. So that's the general sort of picture. Well, I'd like to illustrate this by means of an example, which is the following. Can people see if I write on that board? Maybe I use a different board. I'll use this one. So here's the problem: to minimize I of y, which is the integral minus 1 to 1 of x to the 4th minus y to the 6th squared dy dx to the power 28 plus, he's always got to laugh, yx squared dx with y at plus or minus 1 is plus or minus 1, and epsilon is a positive number, but it's much less than 1, so like 0.001 or something like this. Okay, now, so here's the problem. We're looking for a y that passes through the points 1, 1, and minus 1, minus 1. Now, this is a problem which is strictly convex with respect to dy dx. So that's an elliptic problem. Its Euler-Lagrange equation is an elliptic ordinary differential equation. We're taught that such problems have smooth solutions. Nevertheless, this integral has a minimizer that is singular at the origin, looks like this. Call it y bar. It looks like x to the 2/3 at the origin, which is the thing that makes this vanish. If you minimize this among smooth functionals, among smooth functions joining the endpoints, you get a completely different curve, or a completely different pair of curves. There is a minimizer among smooth functions, and it looks something like this. It is really quite surprising. You see, this thing that is minimizing the integral has derivative which is plus infinity here. So here the Tonelli set E is a single point, namely the point 0. So the derivative is plus infinity there. Therefore, the integrand is plus infinity there. So it's a bit surprising the first time you see it that it could help to minimize the whole integral to have the integrand infinite somewhere. But it does, because it puts you into greener pastures elsewhere. It keeps you actually closer to this curve. Now, what's remarkable is, and what's sort of shown in this picture, is that if y is a smooth function, in fact, if y is even Lipschitz and satisfies the boundary conditions, then I of y, the infimum of I over such y, is strictly bigger than I at y bar, which is the infimum over all functions. And in fact, even more is true. This phenomenon, incidentally, is called the Lavrentier phenomenon, and it plays an important role in the current theory, harmonic maps and so on. In fact, what's more is true, if you took a sequence of smooth functions which were converging almost everywhere to y bar, then the values of I along those functions would converge to plus infinity. So it's forced away from this in the space of smooth functions. Well, why is it? Now, this function y bar does not satisfy the integrated form of the Euler-Lagrange equation, which is df dp is the integral of df dy plus a constant. It does not satisfy it over the whole interval. Why is that? I mean, what goes wrong? Well, how would you calculate the Euler-Lagrange equation? You take your y bar and you look along some line in the function space. So here's a typical point, y bar plus tor phi. You try and differentiate along that line with respect to tor. But in this kind of example, you find that if phi is non-zero at the origin, you find that I of y bar plus tor phi is infinity if tor is not equal to zero. So it causes you problems in, of course, differentiating along that line. You have less variations that you can use, therefore you get less information. You don't get the Euler-Lagrange equation. Okay. Right, now I want to turn to the multidimensional theory. Let me consider a generalization of the problem we were considering in one dimension. So now I've got the integral I of y, which is the integral over some omega of f of x, y, and the gradient of y dx. And here f, I'll always assume for simplicity to be a smooth function of its arguments, and I'm interested now in vector-valued functions. Omega will be some region in Rn, say bounded and open, with a reasonably smooth boundary, so say d omega Lipschitz. It's not so important. And the y's, the mappings y, will take omega to Rm. So dy at x, for any x, we can think of this, we can identify it with the matrix of the partial derivatives of the components of y with respect to the components of x. And for each x, that is a matrix, it's an m by n, a real m by n matrix. And I'll call the set of such matrices capital M of m cross n. Now, viewed from a modern perspective, perhaps the most important development in the modern theory was a paper of Murray in 1952. And what he did was identify the appropriate generalization of convexity for multiple integral problems. So we saw that for one-dimensional problems. The correct condition that occurred all over the place was that f of x and y and p was convex in p. Now, what is the correct condition in the vectorial case? Well, you replace convexity by quasi-convexity. And what is quasi-convexity? Well, let's take the case when f just depends on the gradient, which contains the essential difficulties. So now a definition. So let's take an m by n matrix A. We say that f is quasi-convex at A if the integral over omega of f of A plus the gradient of phi dx is bigger than or equal to its value when phi is zero. So here we're just integrating a constant on the right-hand side, and that's for all phi smooth functions, say C1 functions, which vanish at the boundary. So C1 functions taking values in Rm, which vanish at the boundary. So this, what we've got here is the gradient of a typical function which has the boundary values ax. Okay. It's the gradient of a of ax plus phi. So this is a typical function that equals ax on the boundary, and f is quasi-convex at a, provided that the minimum of this integral is given by the boundary values, namely ax. And then we say that f is quasi-convex if it is quasi-convex for all a, at all a. Well, this is a very puzzling thing the first time you see it, and even the second and third times you see it. In fact, we're all very puzzled about this definition, but the one thing we know about it is that it's the central, or one of the things we know about it is that it's the central condition of the multidimensional calculus of variation. So first of all, some sort of remarks. So one, it's the condition is independent of omega. So it might look as if it depends on omega, but it doesn't. This is a kind of scaling argument. Secondly, it is a generalization of convexity. So if either of the dimensions is 1, either m is 1 or n is 1, then f is quasi-convex if and only if f is convex. If both dimensions are bigger than 1, it is definitely different from convexity. How can one decide whether a given function is quasi-convex? Well, we don't know that in general. I come to that in a moment. But we do know some implications, that f polyconvex implies that f is quasi-convex, implies that f is rank 1 convex. So what do these things mean? Well, f polyconvex means that f of A can be written as a convex function of the list of all minors of the matrix A, all the subdeterminants of all orders. So, for example, if both dimensions were 3, there would be 9 1-by-1 minors, the elements of the entry of the matrix A, 9 2-by-2 minors, and 1 3-by-3 minors. So this is asserting that there is a convex function in when both dimensions are 3 on R19 such that f of A can be written like this. That's polyconvexity. So an example is a minor itself. Any minor itself is quasi-convex. Rank 1 convexity means that if I take the second derivative in the direction of a matrix of rank 1, which is a tensor product of two vectors, then this is bigger than or equal to 0. And this is a version, if you put a strict sign here, with A and N non-zero, this is the same thing as strong ellipticity of the Euler-Lagrange equations. Now, it's known that the converse implication here is not true. I come to this other direction in a moment. Now, what is important about quasi-convexity? Well, what Murray showed was that F, under some technical growth assumptions, which I don't want to get into, he showed that F, X and Y dot quasi-convex is necessary and sufficient for I to be sequentially weakly lower semi-continuous on the Sobolev space W11 of maps from omega to Rn. Well, it doesn't really matter whether you know what this means or not. If you know, I don't need to explain it. If you don't know, I don't have the time to explain it. But the point is that this is what makes the direct method of the calculus of variations work. And so as a consequence, if you know that F is quasi-convex with respect to the last variable and satisfies certain growth conditions, then you get existence of a minimizer. So this implies existence of a minimizer of I in A. Now, in some sense, it's also necessary for the existence of minimizers of I in A. If you have a function that depends just on the gradient and you want to have existence of a minimizer when you add on any lower order term in X and Y, then it is necessary that F be quasi-convex. Now, quasi-convexity plays all sorts of other interesting roles in the theory. For example, an important an important special case is that of elasticity theory. So when both dimensions are 3, so this is elasticity, so in this case I of y is just a function of the gradient of y dx. This is the stored energy function or free energy function of the material. So for some materials you could use theorems such as this or variants of them to prove the existence of a minimizer. Now on the other hand, in recent years we've been interested in problems for which this W is not quasi-convex. And that occurs for elastic crystals, alloys for which you can get changes of phase involving a change in shape of the material. And for such materials, W is not quasi-convex. And so what happens is, when you take a minimizing sequence for this integral, a sequence of deformations, Y, which give you the less and less energy, tending to the least, to the infimum of the possible energy, then for such minimizing sequences, the gradients oscillate more and more, just as in this example, one on the top of the board. And the minimum of the energy is in general not attained. And this finer and finer oscillation of the deformation gradient is a way of modeling the microstructure you see in all materials that undergo solid phase transformations. In all sort of knives and forks and so on, you see lots of microstructure. And you can think of it as being a result of the material trying to minimize its energy, but the only way it can do it is by introducing finer and finer oscillations in its gradient. On the other hand, if you look at a larger length scale, you don't see these oscillations. Now, that's equivalent to looking at the track of Young's generalized curve, or the weak limit of the deformation Y. So if you want to look at the problem that characterizes the macroscopic deformation at a length scale bigger than all these very fine microstructures that are going on, then that problem is to minimize not this integral, but to minimize I hat of y, which is the integral of qw of the gradient of y dx over omega, and qw is the quasi-convexification of W. That is the supremum of all quasi-convex functions that are less than the original one. So this is an example of a relaxed problem of the calculus of variations. And you see that even though the original functional is not quasi-convex, the quasi-convexity plays a very important role in analyzing it. So there are many other applications of quasi-convexity to things such as optimal design that I don't have time to discuss. Yes, I mean it's the supremum of all, the supremum of quasi-convex functions is quasi-convex. That's why it's really right. So now to open problems. So the first of these problems is the one, if I had 12 hours of Isaac Newton's time, I would put him to work on. Whether he could do it in 12 hours, I don't know. It's to characterize quasi-convexity. So we're in the very awkward situation of having a condition which we know is the central condition of the subject, but we have no idea how to verify whether a given function f satisfies it or not. Now, I said that that f quasi-convex implies f rank 1 convex. So it stood for many years as a an open problem, probably at that time the major open problem of the calculus of variations as to whether the converse was true or not. And for example, in 1966, that's quite a long time after Murray's original paper, in his book, he said the following. He said, it is an unsolved problem to prove or disprove the theorem that every rank one convex function is quasi-convex. Well, then in 1992, Vladimir Shvarek found a celebrated counterexample of a function that was rank one convex but not quasi-convex. This works for the dimensions I'll get exactly right, n bigger equal to 2 and m bigger equal to 3. M is the dimension of the range, and it's a quartic polynomial. The cases when, for example, m equals n equal 2 remains open and is very important. It may be that a rank 1 convexity is equivalent to quasi-convexity in this case. So with this counterexample, we no longer had even a conjecture as to what might be a characterization of quasi-convexity. Now, going back to Murray's original paper, at that point, probably he didn't think that these two things were equivalent, which was right, but he said the following. He said, in fact, after a great deal of experimentation, the writer is inclined to think that there is no condition of the type discussed which involves f and only a finite number of its derivatives, and which is both necessary and sufficient for quasi-convexity in the general case. And in fact, last year, Jan Christensen, who is here today, adapted or used Shvarek's counterexample to show, in fact, that there is no local condition, in particular, no condition involving any number of derivatives of f at a particular matrix A, no local condition that is necessary and sufficient for quasi-convexity, for f to be quasi-convex. Right, now, so if there's going to be a characterization, it can't be a local one. About the only thing that I can think of is that it could be perhaps a characterization of the type that f is the supremum of a family of special quasi-convex functions, some kind of analog of corresponding results for convex functions where you have convex functions, a supremum of affine functions, and so on. But we don't know. It's very important. It's extremely inconvenient using this condition. It's technically very difficult to use, and it's really a counsel of despair, in my view, to think that we can't learn something better. So that's the first major open problem. The second one I just mentioned very briefly would be to generalize Weierstrass's local fundamental sufficiency theorem. To multiple integrals. So what you need here is a set of necessary conditions and then a very slight strengthening of them to get a set of sufficient conditions for a given y bar to be a local minimizer of I in, say, well, a variety of different spaces. Who knows what the best one is? Say W1P for P finite, or LP, maybe for P less than or equal to infinity. We want necessary and sufficient conditions, or more or less necessary and sufficient conditions, for a given Y bar to be a local minimizer in one of those spaces. And so the conjecture would be that the necessary and sufficient conditions would be the first variation vanishing as before, the second variation strictly positive. And then to replace this, a strengthening of the quasi-convexity condition, because the generalization of the Weierstrass condition is to say that at each point x of a minimizer, f of x, y bar of x dot is quasi-convex at dy bar of x. That's the generalization of the Weierstrass condition to multiple integrals. As far as I'm aware, none of these methods that can be used to prove this theorem, in particular the field theory, we know cannot be used to attack this problem, not in generality, and that's more or less because polyconvexity does not imply quasi-convexity. Right, so the third open problem, it's well known now that elliptic problems of the calculus of variations, really good elliptic problems, well-behaved elliptic problems, typically have singular minimizers. So, for example, there was one constructed by Natras, I suppose it must be about the 1970s. He constructed a strictly convex F that just depends on the gradient. And that's what's interesting about his example, such that, and it's smooth and strictly convex, such that, the y's take a ball in Rn, and they're matrix valued. So they map this ball to Rn squared. So there exists such an F such that the unique minimizer subject to its boundary conditions is given by y bar ij of x is xi xj divided by the absolute value of x. Now the origin is in the ball, and this is a mapping that is Lipschitz but not C1. So that's an example of a very well-behaved problem. It's strictly convex, so it satisfies all the nice convexity conditions you would think of, and growth conditions too, but it has a singular minimizer. So now the question is, how bad can the singular set be? And this is now a classic sort of problem of the calculus of variations, and in the context of quasi-convex integrals, the only result is due to Craig Evans in 1986. He showed that if f of x and y and the gradient is quasi-convex plus some technical hypotheses, growth conditions and the like, then y bar, the minimizer, which exists because it's quasi-convex, belongs to C infinity of omega minus a set E, where E is closed and of Lebesgue measure 0, so L n of E is 0. So now what might open questions in this area be? Well, one would be to find some more counterexamples. I think that would be interesting. So here's some questions. The first would be to ask whether there are examples, if f is a function just of dy, can y bar be, and if you've got a quasi-convex function or something, can y bar be continuous, but can you have a singularity in the derivative? So dy of x tends to infinity as x tends to some point x0. That would be an analog for this kind of integral, which is of interest in elasticity, of the example I showed with Mizell, where the derivative was infinite at the origin. So I mean, this is important for elasticity because if this happened, you might think of a point x0 as being a potential fracture site of the material. So secondly, can we give conditions where really the minimizer is smooth? So when is y bar actually in C infinity of omega with values in Rm, or even better, regular up to the boundary? There's nothing really on boundary regularity of these problems. Now, regularity theory is quite a funny theory the way it's done. I mean, the optimal kind of way of doing it, you would think, but this is not the way one does do it, because it's presumably too difficult to do it this way, is to try and classify singularities. So you'd like to think, well, I look at one of these problems, now, can I associate with every possible kind of singularity that a minimizer might have a particular condition on the integrand? For example, we know one such condition, and that's strict rank one convexity, which is the ellipticity of the integrand, and that we know is essentially necessary and sufficient to prevent singularities in which the deformation gradient dy jumps across a hyperplane. So if you could somehow classify all the possible singularities and list all the conditions that you need to eliminate them, then you'd have, at one swoop, so to speak, a classification of singularities and a regularity theorem, because you would just apply all these hypotheses and then the solution would be smooth. Now, this example here, I should have said n was bigger equal to 3. It certainly doesn't apply to elasticity. It's going from R3 to R9. So perhaps there are special features of low-dimensional problems, say when both dimensions are 3, or when you have, say, rotational invariance, as you do in elasticity, which might have implications for regularity theory. So now, if solutions are not smooth in elasticity theory, then it would be very interesting to extend Evans' theory to cover that case. That appears to be very difficult. So finally, the future. Well, it's dangerous to try and predict the future. In the short term, perhaps the next 10 or 20 years, I would imagine that there's going to be some significant new advances in our understanding of quasi-convexity and its applications, and possibly to a wider range of subjects. For example, one candidate, as far as I'm concerned, though I don't know anything about it really, is topology. We know that there are many topological invariants that can be represented as null Lagrangians. So these are special cases of quasi-convex functions. Nevertheless, we know that you can't characterize quasi-convexity by means of null Lagrangians. So there's possibly a chink in the armor there of something to do. I think that another area where there's likely to be a lot of activity over the next 10 or 20 years is in the relationship between statics and dynamics. You can argue that the calculus of variations is a poor man's way of studying stability theory for dynamical equations having a Lyapunov function. And there's been a lot of interesting work recently on prototype dynamic models, mostly in one dimension, where the minimum is not attained, and where minimizing sequences oscillate more and more, like in example one up there. So the question is then whether, if you follow the dynamics, this energy is supposed to be decreasing, you have a Lyapunov function, will that produce sequences, will that produce deformations, functions that oscillate more and more as time increases? Since we see microstructure in materials, one would think that in some sense that is the case, but the one-dimensional examples give us some surprising counterexamples to that, but maybe in higher dimensions there's somehow more room. See, the point is that the dynamics may not want to take you in the same direction as the paths which reduce the energy. So you can have, for example, an equilibrium that's not a local minimizer in the sense that there's a path leaving it, but the dynamics may not want to take you along that path, and so it may be a stable minimizer. So these questions sort of hit the basis of the energy criterion for stability. So I think to attempt to be more specific in predicting the future would be doomed to failure, but let me end with what I think is a general lesson from history that one can deduce. There's certainly been periods when the calculus of variations has developed significantly, more or less as a branch of pure mathematics. For example, the Weierstrass theory, Tonelli's theory, the Chicago school of the calculus of variations. When during these periods, certain ideas have been discovered, developed, and polished. But these periods have almost all come to an end, a natural end, due to a lack of stimulation from applications. So let me read you a quote from McShane, who was a distinguished member of the Chicago School of the Calculus of Variations, in a very interesting review article in 1978. He said the following: "The problem of Boltzer was the most general of the single integral problems of the calculus of variations. Its mastery gave us the power to answer many deep and complicated questions that no one was asking. The whole subject was introverted. We who were working in it were striving to advance the theory of the calculus of variations as an end in itself, without attention to its relation with other fields of activity." Now, the Chicago School of the Calculus of Variations broke up, perhaps because of this reason. But the stimulus from applications was provided to McShane and other members of that school by the newly developing subject of control theory in the work of Pontryagin and his school in the Soviet Union. As another example, Mori's work on quasi-convexity was ignored for 25 years before it became of great interest due to questions being asked in solid mechanics. So I think it's not too rash a prediction to say that it will be in response to trying to solve new problems thrown up by the world around us that the calculus of variations will flourish in the future, just as its modern era began 300 years ago with problems such as the Brocristi theorem. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Are there any questions or comments?
Comment about the problem about categorizing quasi-convex functions.
Yes.
Big categorization is one thing, but practical terms, getting good sufficient conditions is actually very...
Yes, that's right.
Are there good sufficient conditions?
Apart from the polyconvex functions, there are just isolated examples constructed often in irritating ways, like taking the quasi-convexification of some function and then showing that it's not polyconvex or something. So there's hardly any specific examples known. So it's really, in these problems of microstructure, we're in desperate need of having larger families of quasi-convex functions, but we don't have them.
It should be said in relation to John's remarks towards the end of his lecture that he himself has been very much involved over many years in problems of solid mechanics as well as in problems in calculus variations, particularly variational problems arising in solid mechanics and in the structure of materials. So he's a perfect example sort of person who defines and identifies the problems starting from the applied side, the problems that then provide a great challenge for mathematicians. I think that perhaps, given the time and the fact that I spent over long in making my introductory remarks, we ought to adjourn for refreshments next door. So may I invite you all to come and take a glass of wine. But may I also thank John Ball. I think you'll agree from this brilliant lecture and this wonderful survey of the subject, there's no question that we chose the right person to celebrate this occasion. Thank you very much. Let's say also that we have a little experimental demonstration of the Bibliotheca, and I posed this as a challenge to three of my research students on Friday. I gave them a very short time, as you see, in the Newtonian spirit, and they have constructed my experiment.